The days of humans working are coming to an end. So dial-up internet, equivalent to game, will take 3 months. You don't have the trainees at the bottom anymore, you don't need them. How do you actually climb the ladder? But I think eventually, we're all going to end up units of production. We have to go and find work and market ourselves and network or get our AIs to go and talk to 435,000 AIs looking for someone with my skill set. And 10 years later, I still can't walk down the street without, you know, some 17-year-old saying, oh, hello, can I have a selfie to my mates on Snap? And I'm like, what the hell? Well, that's not a good story for TV.
No.
Then you've got the bigger issue about what the hell are we going to be doing all day?
Piers, welcome to the podcast.
I found you.
You found us. Yeah. We were searching for you all over
planes,
London.
Trains, bikes, walking.
You made it. You made
it. Mule at the end.
It was a very trustworthy mule.
Yeah.
We like to start with a big open question. So I hope you sat comfortably. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Oh, okay. So I think I've got an answer for this because ChatGPT gave it to me.
Beautiful. ChatGPT will put the handle
so I think my skill set actually over many years of different experience, lots of different things, is I'm kind of very broad, long distance things, and over the years that kind of horizontally, and I wasn't very good at lots of things, but now over the years I've become very good at lots of different things. So my skill set, problem I solve, I think I'd say, is that I can look at opportunities, situations, or even people, and I can piece together and maybe things that people don't really see that I can see because I've got experience across the board. And I think also my skill set that's kind of derived from that is I think I'm pretty good at explaining complex things to people, depending on who they are, what their experience is, what their understanding is. So I say that's my superpower.
Nice. I like that, the complex ideas into simple ideas. So if people are listening to this, why are you better qualified to take a complex idea and make it simple? Why should they listen to you?
So anybody who professes to know anything about anything, it's about two things, isn't it, really? One is about having an understanding of the underlying theory, perhaps. So my background is I'm a lawyer by training. I've been a corporate financier. I study corporate finance. I've got a law and accounting degree. I've done my banking qualifications. That's all good. But then it's the application of it in the real world. So that's where you can then take that understanding, that knowledge, whether it's scientific or it's business related, or in my case, it's sort of professional services, and apply that in the real world. That's where you start to understand, well, how does it impact people? How do they respond? How do they think? You put those two things together, and that's what gives you a skill set. So my skill set is again horizontally, lots of things I can do well. And of the, say there's 10 of them, I say 8 of them I'm an expert in, and 2, I'm still learning.
Well, let's start then with a complicated thing, and you tell us what's going on simply. So AI has got people either thinking it's the end of the world or it's nothing to worry about. What's the truth?
So AI is going to change our world. That is absolutely inevitable. It depends on what people get lost on, a couple of things. So one is time horizons, and then breaking it down. So you've got to break it down into knowledge work, the knowledge labor, I'd say physical labor as well. So the Industrial Revolution, which is, I grew up in the north of England, like a mill town basically. So Industrial Revolution is what all those entrepreneurs of the age, what got me interested in business. So, but the Industrial Revolutions, you know, the first steam engines, physical labor, then you had consumerization, electrification, then you had, you know, the third Industrial Revolution, web communications. Those things were tools, really. So this pyramid of labor has been filled with tools, and we've had to kind of move up to the top and do the things that we're good at and use those tools. But the pyramid got bigger. You know, we had the working class, the middle class, GDP grew globally. Difference now is that pyramid has been filled with tools, but now intelligence. Mm. Now, historically, you know, anyone who knows anything about B2B software as a service, SaaS, for example, lots of your clients are B2B SaaS companies. Why do they charge you per hour per user? Sorry, per user per month? Because you need a human to operate it. So that's kind of going to go away. So imagine this pyramid's been filled. The pyramid's not getting any bigger. So in some places, human populations are shrinking in many places. So we have to start thinking about, actually gets filled up faster. How do you migrate to the top and add value? And you're not kind of washed over as this intelligence begins to sort of rise within that pyramid, because it is a fixed size, I'd say now. And the other thing we don't understand is exponentials. So exponentials are, best example, I think, is say, you read about someone having a bit of an outbreak of a influenza or something like it in some town called Wuhan. And you're kind of like, what the hell? I've never even heard of Wuhan. Where is it? And then 6 months later, however long it was, you can't leave your house by law, okay? That is exponential change. That's geometric growth. And that's what we're experiencing. And I say that in AI, if you compare it to, say, COVID, if you wanted to, we're now at the stage where somebody's left the market or the lab, depending which theory you believe, and they've just jumped on a plane to go to America for holiday.
Yeah.
You know, the first two people, we're kind of there in AI, right? So AI today, people look at it, they go, yeah, you know, but it can't do this and it can't do that. It is dial-up internet, right? And I grew up in the age of dial-up internet. I was actually in my teens. So dial-up internet to, I've got a Starlink on my van conversion, right? That took 30 years. The equivalent in AI will take 3 years. And then equivalent again will take 3 months. And then it'll be 3 weeks, 3 days, 3 hours, 3 minutes. That's exponential growth. And we humans who spent 200,000 years evolving on the savannah where nothing really changed, don't get it. We also don't get it because even in our lifetimes, I'm a bit older than you guys, that, you know, my grandparents were educated in exactly the same way as my daughters are being educated. So our world doesn't change. But I'm telling you right now, it's about to change in everything. Societally, business, the way you operate businesses, the way we interact with each other. There's nothing that won't be impacted. And the last thing I'd say, and I will shut up, is that AI today is, you hear this thing, it's the worst it's ever going to be. But the AI we're using now, that might not be the technology that wins through. There are issues with, you know, AI, large language models churning out tokens about reasoning and, you know, real intelligence. And it may be there just a stepping stone on the way to something which is far more powerful. And you can get into talking about artificial general intelligence where it's better than humans or cognitive tasks. And then super intelligence where it starts doing things that we don't understand. So that's knowledge work, right? Now put that technology into robots, let's call it. People say, oh, but robots aren't very good yet. Can you do a backflip? I mean, probably like you can. can you do parkour, right? So they're quite good at that stuff, but, you know, taste, smell, touch, not quite there yet, but it's coming. So a decent robot within, say, 5 years will be, what, 50 grand for something really capable. What's 50 grand if you buy a car? I don't know, 600 quid a month, maybe, on finance, depending on what the interest rate is. Compared to what a human's costing you, never sleeps, never stops work, is never ill. So the technology that's now been implanted into robots that can understand our built environment, it can see, they're gaining all of our senses. So then you get into a world where physical labor starts to be taken over as well. So my daughters, my stepson, they're kind of like 16, 14, by the time they're my age, maybe even your age, you probably won't get insurance for humans to work on a building site, drive a car around a city. So this is happening, and anybody that's not aware of it and is engaged with the technology at a personal level, at a business level, even at a national level, governments, in an exponential world, catching up is very hard to do.
I'll tell you what, you're as advertised, aren't you? You said, I'll take a complicated thing and I'll make it simple.
Was that simple? I'm not sure.
I think it was. I think you
I got it.
Simplify it again if you want. But there's lots to it, but people just, they don't understand.
No, but then I think, so from what you just said there, if I'm a business owner, listeners, or a business leader, I'm probably thinking, right, well, where's the risk that I need to get ahead of, but also where's the opportunity? So what are you saying?
So I do lots of like keynotes, you know, business leaders, that's the business to implement AI, that's what we do basically. And I'd say approach it systematically. So you've got, I look at like a 2x2 matrix. Imagine a chart with 2x2. So the y-axis is the technological frontier, let's call it that. So the technology. So you've got the like sort of concentric rings, really. So you've got all the PR noise. I go home now. I see my mum, who's 85. Hello, mum, how are you? She goes, sit down, make you a cup of tea. Just talk me through this deep seek. My mum. Wow. I'm like, oh, no. So you've got the kind of noise. Ignore that. Then you've got the what they call the jagged technological frontier. And it's jagged because it depends what you're doing, where you are. If you're a copywriter, you know, it's in your face, right? Mm. If you're in healthcare or regulated industry, maybe it's not quite there yet, but it's jagged, okay? But within that, I'd say you've got what we call implement AI, the operational frontier. This is where this technology works today, right? So you've got technology that works And then you've got the ROI. So the ROI might be, it might be very, very high by if you deploy the technology to do something or work in a team where it kind of works, but it's not quite there yet, but it will be maybe 6 to 12 months. Or you may have a slightly lower ROI, but it works. So my advice is that's where you start. And you start by augmenting yourself, never mind your team. I was at an event last night where lots of people in retail and e-commerce, and I said, oh, who uses ChatGPT? They all put a hand up. And there, some people will be using it to write a poem for their mom's birthday, right? Or asking them, you know, tell me something about myself, I don't know, that kind of thing. But if you don't use it a lot, it's not going to know. So and then I say to them, who's ever taken a picture with it and asked it to describe the room? No one puts a hand up. So the key is learning how to use it yourself, because then you start to understand the capability where you can deploy it in your business. And then you've got to have a team that understand this and take them on the journey, but pick things that work and actually there's a measurable return on investment. So it improves what they can do, how they do it. AI can do things that humans can't do. We do lots of voice, for example. Data analytics, it can just analyze data at a scale that humans just can't even comprehend. And that's where you start. Pick workflows, processes that you can automate and add value. And don't worry about anything else yet, because think of those concentric rings that I talked about, that the outer noise is going to become the technological frontier. And that frontier is very quickly going to become the operational frontier. And there's something else, and it keeps doing that all the time. But the key is to start, because often you're going to have to rethink your workflows and processes, your organization, your business. It could be third sector, it could be government. You have to rethink how you actually do things, because you can empower your people, going back to that pyramid, stop doing the mundane, the repetitive, and focus on your most expensive resource, typically, cleaning up what you guys do, are people. So you don't want them doing repetitive work where you get high churn in jobs where people are doing stuff that's not really meaningful. Now, there's going back to horizons, I'd say that's 5 years. 10 years, 20 years, there's a whole different podcast about what we're going to be doing all day.
Well, let's dive into it. So the mundane, okay, you get rid of that. Who are the people that, what when you have conversations, what do you typically see being replaced? What jobs straight away are, well, that's not going to be applicable. We're not going to need that. We can replace that straight away.
This is something relevant to you. So I was in a conversation last night with somebody who owns a creative agency, actually. And there was somebody else who's got a retailer, an online retailer. And one of their marketing team has asked them, saying, we need to hire a copywriter. No, you don't ever gonna need to hire a copywriter ever again. That's a very simple, obvious one that you can use whatever large language model you prefer, set up a project or GPT or whatever you want to call it. And you can go in there, give it some information about, you know, world-class B2B copywriting, give them examples, explain your business tone of voice or your client's tone of voice. And you've got the best copywriter in the world sitting there. Blow your mind. So that's one. Then typically though, what you have are workflows and processes. So you've got people in a workflow, it might be 10 steps. And you look at it and you go, okay, of the 10 steps, there are three that are pretty mundane and unnecessary really. They should be automated. And there are seven that the human needs to do. Mm. What you want to try and do is automate 1 to 4, 4 to 7, not 1 and 10, because there's too many steps in the middle. But what you have to do now is, if you think of almost like humans, and we call them AI agents or digital workers, they have an interface. It might be an API or a webhook. So within your process, as the information or the data or whatever needs to flow is flowing through it, there comes a point where you have to go to a human in the loop. So it gets sort of sent off to a human in the loop. They do their thing. And then there's another connection, whatever you want to call it, back to the AI or another human. And then back to the AI. That's how you do it. So it's augmenting people now, I would say. It's not getting rid of them. There are some jobs that are going to go away. The one I talk about most often, I would say, are things like call centers. Mm. Yeah. You probably, within 2 years, the technology will be there. It might not be fully deployed, but it will be there where you're not going to need humans answering phones, unless it's very high value. So you've got kind of value, velocity, and variability, okay? So if you've got something that's very high value, you're trying to sell a Bentley to somebody, you're probably not going to call them an AI agent, okay? A lot of velocity, lots of throughput, technology is very good at that as well. Variability, if it changes a lot, you might need humans in the loop. If it's pretty consistent, then an AI can do it very, very well. Then you've got plus risk. So risk is, if it's a regulated activity, healthcare, financial services, you've got to think about the risk. But even in regulated industries, the point where you prescribe something or give financial advice, I get it, but before you get there, you've got all the other processes and systems and workflows and sales funnels any other business has got. So you automate that as much as you possibly can. So augment people, analytics, it does things humans can't. So any business, don't care how big your business is, you've got data and there are insights in there that I call the unknown unknowns. You know what you're looking for, typically. You have dashboards for the known knowns, research and the known unknowns. But the unknown unknowns are where you say, we've got clients where we've done this, look at our data, tell me something I don't know. Got one client, 400 million in revenue. By doing that, they found a £2 to £4 million revenue opportunity. They were costing probably, I don't know, 100 grand a year. That's it. So augmentation, using in ways to do things that you can't do. Now, there are some roles where, like copywriting, that people are just not going to be needing those roles. And this is not admin assistants, PAs, drivers. This is lawyers. This is accountants. This is surgeons eventually. Because now the robotic, you see those surgeons where they can do origami with the needles remotely. Mm. Now you just put an AI on the end of it, not a human, which probably make even fewer mistakes. So that's coming very, very quickly. But I don't think people quite understand how quickly that's coming because a lot of the tech is there. And the last thing I would say is, if you imagine a human, a remote worker, or somebody using, say, software as a service, or somebody working in a low-cost labor economy, what do? They sit at a computer, they look at a screen, they know what's on it, they respond to it. They move a mouse and they type. So now, whether it's a computer use or operator, they've all got different names for it. It's not very good yet, but it's getting there. The AI can operate a mouse and a keyboard. So you think about it, where does that go? Number one is you don't need a screen anymore, really, because AIs don't need a screen. They're looking at the screen, not visually, at the operator level. Kind of taking pictures now, but eventually it'll be at the OS level. So the only reason you need a screen on these computers, really, and a keyboard, is so humans can interact or see what the hell is going on. Another thing people don't quite grasp is the internet's going away. So as people look at me blankly, and I sort of say, like you're doing right now. and I say, well, think about it. You're going to have an agent. You know, my agent knows everything about me. He knows it's got my ECG. And I'm going to say, I want to buy a barbecue for the weekend. My mum and dad are coming around. I've got 200 quid. I'll pay 150 for secondhand one. So this agent knows everything about you. He knows your mood, knows your heartbeat. It knows your body temperature, it knows your likes, your dislikes, your budget, how much in your bank account, how much money you need next week in your sort of budgeting. And it's going to go off and instantaneously, like high-frequency trader, talk to 400,000 barbecue retailers, not websites, the AIs,
yeah.
Do a deal, negotiate, come back. And if you've given authority to purchase, it'll just buy it. It'll say, look, I've actually got the secondhand one. It's pretty good, Nick. I've had a look at it. And it's coming by drone or whatever tomorrow. So it'll be here on time. That will be e-commerce. And my grandchildren, if I have them, I'll talk about dial-up internet and they'll think I'm completely bonkers. But I'll tell them about the internet, where we used to go on the internet and browse around these virtual shops. And we used to have these search engines that used to generate loads of results that you needed a search engine to go through. So that is going away. SEO going away.
Wow.
That's like 5 years. That's not 10 years away.
There's a million ways to say that, because obviously there would still be a place you'd hope for e-commerce and like the advertisements and how they make their money. But I guess I want to sit. We've had this conversation a few weeks ago. We were talking about copywriters and I could go away now, set my own marketing agency, get something like Sora. You've got ChatGPT where you can create your images, your copywriting. Surely there are going to be a lot of people that go, well, I don't even want to think about the copywriting, so they'd hire a one-man band or something like that. Are you seeing that will creatives still have a place in the world because actually one creative who speaks to the AI copywriting will be better than another, or actually is AI just going to take over and there's probably no need for even the inputs?
So I go back to my pyramid analogy again. So the, you know, the ideas, interfacing with our clients, understanding their drivers in life and what they're trying to achieve. We're probably better at that now. I say you need to have EQ, not IQ. Mm-hmm. IQ is going to be productized, commoditized, and it's going to zero cost IQ for sure. So say in your business, and I had the conversation, and I was telling you earlier, with somebody who's got a creative agency, and they're saying that really they're doing the work. So producing images, you know, now you can produce images even in ChatGPT 4.0, where you can put somebody in a t-shirt in your brand colors and put your logo on it, anybody you want, and swap out what they look like quite easily. So the actual production will be automated. What you have to do is move up the pyramid again at the top and be the consultant. It's the strategy and the analysis actually is where the value is going to be. The production, not so much. Because now you're A-B testing. Why A-B test? You can A-B-D, you can go to Z test if you wanted to all at once and automate it. Now, the issue is that the implementation capability is not quite there yet. So what you're going to see is a lot of SaaS companies introducing AI. So it looks good. It's a bit of marketing maybe, or some cases it can add some more value. But think about software as a service, all these applications we all use and they all overlap and we've got too many of them and there's 10 subscriptions you've got, you don't even know why you've still got them. You think about them, the cost per user per month is because a human's got to work it. Type, move a mouse, move levers, look at things, transpose data. Now the agents, if they can start using computers, which they can do now, can start operating the software as a service. So those two layers almost collapse into one. So in the future, you'll be able to say, right, I want a campaign. Okay, here's my customer database. This is the ICP for this campaign. This is the kind of creative and the client's thinking about. Here's an example. You'll show it, however you want to do that. Can you put together a campaign or an email flow, whatever it might be? Here's the objective. Here's the product. This is the cost. This is the cost per click or the acquisition cost we're willing to sort of absorb. Off you go. So the AI will just go and do it. You're not going to need some CRM. And when it comes back, you're like, nah, that's not quite right. So you're going to be talking to technology as well. I mean, that's kind of here today. But all those bits and pieces aren't quite there yet. So what you're using are the tools to do the output, the ability for something to really talk to you, reason, and deliver the outcome, even with agentic teams, teams of AIs, isn't quite there yet. It's kind of what we do. And as the technology improves, always remember, people always say, it doesn't do this. So I always say, always add, you need like a stamp, hyphen yet. Stamp on everything, basically. Because if I said to you, so I'll give a great example. So have you used deep research?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. So depending on which one you use and how you use it and the prompting, but it's very powerful. I use it quite a lot. Deep research. So you take the deep research. So say I did one for a laugh on it's on LinkedIn. And I said, look, do some research on the impact on the US insurance industry of the incidence of large hailstones. I had a strong coffee that morning. So I think this random, boring research goes off, 23-page report, like a PhD has done it over a week of work and research, comes back. I don't want to read it really. I want to focus on, say, Texas. So now you can get it to focus on Texas. I upload that to via Google Notebook LM. So these are things people are starting to use. Never used it?
No.
Okay. Well, here's your homework. So do some research or a document you've written yourselves or your business plan. Upload it to Google Notebook LM. And this is more for research and learning, but it's very powerful. It will turn it, I hate to say, into a podcast. A podcast about that subject that is indistinguishable from two humans having a conversation.
Wow. Right?
You can then prompt it to say, in the podcast, focus on the impact in Texas. So it'll skew towards the general conversation, but more about Texas. Then you can press interact. It's still a beta, I think. And it'll say, oh, Piers wants to join. So you join and say, hello, look, hi, Piers. Welcome to the podcast. You say, actually, never mind Texas. What about New York State? And I go, okay, well, it'll talk about that. Because these podcasts have also got access to all human knowledge. Right? So they'll talk about that, then it'll go back to the podcast. So I show people that. That's how I learn now. I don't listen to podcasts, really. I like the ones that I like. I create them on the fly, listen to them on the train or when I'm driving, wherever I am. And I show people that and they say, yeah, but they've both got American accents. And you're just like, what the hell? Because they'll fix that very soon as well. And that's the issue with it. No matter what you show people, there was yes, but. But if I explain that to you, what, 2 years ago, you'd think two things. One, I'm insane. Or two, it's witchcraft.
So we're talking very kind of coalface. If you're in a business now, here's probably how you're feeling and the things that you're worried about. What about a societal level? So if you've got a teenage son or daughter.
Which I have.
Yes, me too. So what should we be thinking of there? Where are those kind of early disruptions that you'll be experiencing?
So I was a trustee of Nesta, UK's largest innovation foundation, for 6 years, about a £600 million endowment. And did a lot of research on robotics and AI. That's where I first got interested in automation. It was more automation then than machine learning. It wasn't generative AI, but a lot of work on education. And the education system, you know, the old 3R system, you know, we're still learning so we can go and work in a mill, you know, and just learn the instructions for the loom, how many bales of whatever we've made. That's kind of it, really. And add it up. That was what we were learning for. And education, sadly, is very hard to move because of the machinery around it. So I think the danger is, and I always say this is about individual agency, using it yourselves, your organization, but at the nation state level. And sadly, and I've worked at nation state level. I've worked in, you know, I was on the board of the government bank during COVID, where we rolled out 90 billion of finance, right? So I've seen how government operates pretty close up. And even with the greatest will in the world, it's slow. So you're going to see things like, let's talk about education, that, you know, my daughter now, you know, your kids, she's doing one's doing GCSEs, one's doing her first year A-levels. And she's like, oh, the teacher's not very good. And I'm kind of like, okay, whatever. Here's the curriculum. Create an AI or GPT or project, whatever it is. Here's the curriculum. There's all the notes and content you've already got. Let's do a gap analysis. What don't you know? Let's test what you do know first. Oh, that's pretty good, actually. Right, let's do a gap analysis. What you don't you know? You don't know this stuff. Right, so let's create flashcards, notes, and tests and tissue stuff you don't know. Very quickly, they're caught up. So the actual teacher really becomes more like a seminar to fill in the gaps. So education is going to change dramatically. You can educate yourself now, have a perfectly patient teacher that can teach you anything, any language, any subject, anytime you want, at any level you want as well. That exists today. You don't have to go and buy it. You can do it, well, you probably pay for one of the AIs, but that's available right now, education. Then you've got the bigger issue about what the hell are we going to be doing all day? So 5-year horizon, okay? AI, who's using it? Who are the winners? Who are the losers? Go out 10 years, robots start to work in hospitals, you know? And they're kind of humanoid or different form factors, depending what environment they're working in, they need to operate in. 20 years out, I mean, all bets are off. You know, 20 years out, you might have AGI, ASI, who knows? Robots will be looking after our parents quite happily, actually, because you know they're going to do a great job and you trust them, they're infallible. So 20 years out, what we will do all day for work, I don't know, because I really do think that the days of humans working are coming to an end.
Are there things then that you think will be replaced that shouldn't be? It's almost short-term thinking to think, let's replace that because of the long-term impact.
So what you've got to think about is our system evolves around the bottom line, doesn't it? So people always say, oh, but AI, you know, it should slow it down. So you've got two main drivers. One is capitalism. So there are literally, you read about it all day, billions and billions and billions of dollars, pounds, euros, yen, whatever currency you want to choose, going into artificial intelligence, or robotics actually as well. So that's number one. And they want a return. So, and businesses, and the interesting thing with artificial intelligence is, if you look at most innovation or adoption curves, so they start slowly. It's called Amari's Law, where technology, you always think it takes longer to be adopted than we always think it will. But once it is, it takes off a lot faster, essentially. So think about artificial intelligence is that globally, organizations, the big ones, the governments, they've done the research, right? And they know the impact of it. If you've got billions of revenue and you move your margin by Amazon, for example, you move your margin by 1%, that's just cash, ka-ching, to the bottom line. And if you're valued on 15 to 30 times your price earnings, your earnings, your price earnings are multiple, how companies are, especially public companies, tend to be valued, that just times that by 30. So that's where you see companies trying to implement sort of knowledge work capabilities, and then robotics, because it falls straight to the bottom line. So the system is going to drive to the bottom as fast as possible, because it's just margin. And then as everybody starts to have this technology, going back to my high frequency trading e-commerce, then if you ever studied economics, perfect information, perfect markets, it becomes very hard to make a margin. Because if I've got to negotiate with 452,000 barbecue retailers in a millisecond, you know, going back to your point, actually, that's where branding might come back, because I wonder, which one do I choose? You might come back and say, out of the 435,000 barbecue retailers, I chose that one. You go, well, I don't want that one. I want this one because I saw it on whatever.
Yeah.
So that might go away. So then the second dimension is nation states. So in AI, if you get to AGI, artificial general intelligence, or artificial, say, super intelligence first, on Monday, state X and state Y solves it on, say, Tuesday or Wednesday, it'll never catch up. Because it's an exponential. The rate of change is so great, you'll never catch up. So nation states understand, I don't think AI is going to happen like that. It won't be one day where suddenly it becomes sentient. it'll be a continuum. But nation states understand that winner takes all. So even if you try and stop here or slow it down, I'm not going to go into the names, but there'll be other nation states that absolutely will not have stopped, or they'll pretend they have, because it's more powerful than nuclear weapons.
So it feels like we're in the gold rush era.
It is a gold rush era.
Chat, do you ever get off a sales call and think, I should probably update that CRM? But also, you remember you don't know how to read, write, or spell? All the time. And then you look at your notes, and actually, there are no notes. It's just a picture of a snowman. That's why we've been using Win.ai. It's carrying me over the sailing seas of prospecting. It's pulling our sales is therapy playbook live on screen and nudging you in real time. And then guess what? It magically puts everything into the CRM, so you never need to learn how to write, read, or spell.
It's like having a therapist, sales coach, and a PA all whispering in your ear.
Wow, that sounds beautiful. Because Win AI knows that sales calls should feel like you're being lifted over the clouds rather than buried underneath the ocean of rejection.
And I'm sure that your DMs get bombarded by, we call them like a magpie's shiny object syndrome, yeah, where they're drop shipping or they're, yeah, setting up a new business. For people that are entrepreneurial and they're thinking, right, how am I going to use AI? How am I going to make a load of money? There'll be people that think, right, I'll set up a copywriting business. What would you say are the dead certs that are probably, that we were talking about this off air, but like that have the least amount of risk?
No, definitely not copywriting.
Give up copywriting.
I'll, if you're a put copywriter, that out there right now. So I'll give you a real example. I was at a Goldman Sachs event in Manchester at the Midland, and there's an event, and I was giving a bit of a talk, and I was talking about voice and translation, and this lady, probably mid-40s, came up to me afterwards and said, I'm really concerned about what you just said. I said, why? What do you do? She goes, I've got a translation business. And I was like, well, I think fast, Piers. I said, well, okay, something for your business. Right, so I've got clients, they're quite big clients, some are regulated, it's very important we get it right, a lot of QA. I said, and what's your main cost? People translating it. And what do you enjoy doing? Well, I love like the QA, liaising with the clients, making sure it's right and it fits their particular need. I said, okay, so you can automate a lot of the translation, and you spend the time doing what you enjoy doing. That's where you add the value, top of the pyramid. Mm. Okay, thank you. Anyway, 2 weeks later, I get a message on LinkedIn. I think, thank you, you've completely transformed my business. Now, that's now. So now there's an opportunity. I don't really care what you do, to be honest with you, as long as it isn't copyright. It doesn't matter what you do, there's an opportunity now to augment yourself and your team to be better at what you do. I my output now is probably 3x what it usually used to be, just in terms of nothing I do, whether it's research or even I do all the work and I check it. There's nothing I do cognitively that I don't involve in AI somewhere. Why wouldn't I have this amazing sidekick, this infinitely patient, access to all world knowledge? I can set it up and prompt it to be anything at any time almost. So if you're trying to start a business or operate a business, you've got to think about, I said earlier that your main cost tends to be people. And whenever you try and grow a business, you should have done it yourselves, especially in your business, the frustration is you're growing revenues and your cost is just tracking it. Or worst case, it's narrowing. So what you want is to grow faster by using artificial intelligence and voice and hyper-personalized marketing to engage with customers, engage them faster, engage in ways that the competition isn't doing, and then optimize your cost base by getting more out of the human resource you've got so that your cost base doesn't grow as quickly as your revenue is now growing. And that expansion is margin expansion, it's profit, and it's a more valuable business because most businesses are valued on a multiple of profit. That's the opportunity now. In 5 years to 10 years, the basics become spell check. Everyone's got it and everyone can use it. Or there's an AI that exists to help you use it. So you get that issue as well. So my advice is to go now.
So last night we were staying in Chelsea and me and Zach were showing off.
I was staying in King's Cross.
Not that way. And we were talking about AI and Zach wrote a poem for me using AI and we ended up having a conversation. And I'm not, this whole podcast isn't about copywriters. We're going to move on from that. But we were talking about, okay, well, that poem is probably, the AI has wrote a poem that could write something more beautiful than any copywriter could ever write. So then it gets to the point of like, say you write a book, okay, and I know that you probably would use AI in some form. Does it get to the point where you're not actually behind that process anymore? Do you think that there will be some kind of rebellion against AI? Do you think there will be people that will fight it, and what could that lead to?
Yeah, so, you know, go back to my interest in history, the Luddites and, you know, the people are smashing up machines. And I think you are going to have complexities, if you want to call it that, globally. You're going to have complexities in the UK, you know, call centres. That's what, 800,000 people? Yeah, those jobs are going away, no doubt about it. Basic admin is going away. A lot of creative is under threat, let's face it, okay? Not that you don't need them, you just need fewer of them because you can augment yourself, essentially. The other interesting one, or complicated one, I think, are what people like to call low-cost labor economies. So people in countries where they can, you know, you've got countries, you know, you saw Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, saying, look, we make stuff in China because there's amazing skills there. That's different. I'm on about just people that are doing things because it's cheaper, making things, sewing things, machines, operators, knowledge work, data entry. So once a computer can do all of that, that competitive advantage in those countries goes away. Once a robot costs £1,000 and it can knit a jumper or whatever it needs to do, or make a pair of shoes, then that advantage goes away. So you're going to have an issue in some places around the world where the value of labor goes away a lot faster. Now, think of it the other way around, actually. It might be the other way around, because you might find that if you're working in America, your cost is really high. So AIs now can do a better job than that. But in Europe, you're still here. So there's still you can still compete. But then as the AI cost begins to drop, that's all it's doing. It's going to zero. Suddenly, European employees aren't competitive anymore. It drops again. So maybe it is the low labor economies that scale up, because now they can learn anything using artificial intelligence. But eventually, in that race to the bottom, they're no longer competitive. So knowledge workers are going to have a tough time. And that's everything I've ever done. I've got an accounting degree. I'm a qualified lawyer. I was an investment banker in the city. I've been a hedge fund manager. Everything I've ever done will have little value. And what's going to be interesting for all of us is that where we people got paid the big bucks, you know, the bankers, the knowledge workers, it might be you're going to earn $500,000 a year now being a multilingual masseuse who can cut hair. You know what I mean? It might just completely change. That's actually where the value is now. I don't know. I think there are going to be real complexities, and this is why governments need to start thinking about this sooner rather than later, because if they do it too late, then there's going to be a lot of people who are upset or find themselves without work. Having said all of that, did we really evolve? And I'm not going to pick out any roles in particular, but did we really evolve to do lots of these jobs people do all day? Is that what it's really about? So maybe it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
How you generate income and revenue and tax is another massive complexity.
Yeah, but I suppose if we were to put you back in the Dragon's Den chair today, would you be fundamentally asking a totally different set of questions based on where we are today if someone was coming in for investment?
No, it'd be a similar question, because often you're trying to work out the person is actually, not the business plan, not the operational model. I'm trying to work out, can I work with you? Are you going to actually generate a return? And are you going to be able to put up with the ups and downs of trying to build a business over, let's face it, 10 years? So it's still the person, but I would be asking now about, are you using this technology? Do you understand it? Because if you're trying to run a business now or start a business, like I said, you can have a team of people or at least augment the team you've got to the extent of 2x, 3x, where you don't need to pay much for it. It's thousands of pounds a year, not thousands of pounds a month to have this to augment you. So the risk of starting a business now is declining. It did it with cloud infrastructure, software as a service. It lowered the barriers. And now you can have knowledge workers, eventually physical workers, that are reasonably cheap as well. But the point is, if you wait too long, like I said, it becomes spell check. It becomes the calculator. Everyone's got one. Every SaaS company is now embedded AI into it. You're using the same software as a service. Where is the differentiation? Where is your competitive advantage? And I think that today is going early, getting ahead so you can stay ahead. And also going back to my pyramid analogy is trying to automate all this stuff so that your human resource and yourselves are actually focused on adding value.
Is there a risk of there are things about us that will become fundamentally less intelligent? So i.e. like calculators are a good example. People were probably much better at maths at a point before the calculator because they relied on it more to know it more. Whereas instead I can now kind of outsource it to my calculator. Perhaps critical thinking, I don't really need to do it as much anymore because I can then go, well, actually, I can bang that into an AI to figure that out.
That's going back to the spell check, isn't it? Is that everybody can do basic critical thinking. You know, people always say, oh, well, the best become amazing. The ones in the middle of the road become great and the ones that aren't very good become okay. Mm-hmm. But if you're kind of at the bottom rungs of that ladder, you're not necessary. So I was a lawyer. You know, you look at law firms. Are you really going to recruit somebody and pay them 150 grand a year, what some of them are earning, for 2 years post-qualification? Probably not. So now these organizations look like that. Again, a lot of pyramids in this podcast. You know, the boss, the senior people, the middle management, and the people doing the work looks like that. You may find they become kind of diamond shape, and eventually they invert because all the grunt work can be kind of automated. But the problem there is, the talent pipeline starts to dry up. So as the talent pipeline starts to dry up from the bottom, you're not recruiting these people and training them and giving them experience, you're then almost at the top, you're then forced to automate even more. And then the senior people begin to retire, and then suddenly they almost collapse automatically, these organizations, into nothing. So that's the interesting issue about, I think, talent is, and the bigger issue is, flipping it, you ask about society. So take me for example, right? So I'm a bit of a, you know, people think I didn't grow up in particularly difficult circumstances, right? My mum had a BMW, you know, they were working class parents that worked hard, nurse, my dad worked in management to become sort of middle class, you want to call it that. But you know, I grew up in an interesting area. You'll know it, it's up in North. I went to Burnley College around there. We looked like me. It was quite an interesting place to live at the time. But I progressed and did okay for myself through social mobility. So how do you become socially mobile? And you guys, I'm sure you've done it as well, is that because you learn something, you get educated or you learn on your own, and then you take that knowledge and you apply it into a business or career and you work hard and you climb the ladder and you earn more money and you invest it and it grows and you're socially mobile. The issue with AI is if you think about knowledge work kind of becomes worthless, you don't have the trainees at the bottom anymore, you don't need them. How do you actually climb the ladder? So you might find that actually wealth, the societal structure we have, it almost crystallizes, and that's it. Because if you were me 30 years ago, I can't become a lawyer in the city anymore, an investment banker at Credit Suisse. That's a path that no longer exists. Starting a business, can you do that? Because everyone's doing it. You can automate everything. So my worry is about societies is that the haves will become permanently the haves, and the have-nots will be permanently the have-nots, and there'll be no way, literally, of moving from the bottom rung to the top.
But it feels like there's still that unknown at the moment. So, like, obviously a lot of paths will be shut, but I imagine with that, other paths will...
Back to horizons. 5 years, I agree. 10 years, let's go 20 years out, right? It's maybe not quickly 20 years, as you're going to find out. Maybe quickly 20 years passes. So 20 years out, I think that will be an issue. And that, if you take away people's ability to progress, do better than their parents, or see the results of their hard work and ambition, I think that's when you actually have a bigger issue than people just worrying about, am I going to lose my job?
Maybe people will be copywriting just for fun back in the day. So I want to... Obviously, I imagine your bandwidth now when it comes to investment and investing in new exciting businesses, there are probably lots and lots of opportunities, but you're focused on AI. So if you took AI off the table on the project that you're working on, what problems do you see in the world that need to be solved that you think, actually, I don't have the time or the energy to focus on it, but that is something that people should be focusing on fixing?
Well, so there is another one, which I do spend time and energy on. I was doing something this morning related to that. So you've got artificial intelligence. And the thing I'm sort of spent a lot of my time on. So last year, I was the diversity champion of the year at the European Diversity Awards, right? Don't ask me how I won that award. But the answer actually to that is I do a lot of work with Sky. And Sky invested £30 million over 4 years now into diversity and inclusion, both internally, but also externally. So working things like, you know, Sir Lewis Hamilton, his charity and various other things. And the issue is that ambition, it's a bit like the social mobility point, actually, it's where it kind of comes from for me. Ambition is evenly distributed, right? Perhaps not. If you come from a difficult socioeconomic background, you might be a white working class lad, or you come from an ethnic minority, you actually might be more ambitious because you need to be, right? So maybe, let's just assume it's evenly distributed. Access to capital, support, and guidance as well. And just opportunity isn't. And that's why society still looks the way it does, where the top doesn't look anything like the bottom, right? And I've seen the top in many different ways and guises. You know, I've been to city drinks parties in tuxedos where I'm like, going, I've made it here. And people come up to me and say, hello. And I go, hello. And they say, can I have a glass of champagne and two gin and tonic? That happens. You know what I mean? And I'm like, oh. Now, because I'm me, I laugh it off. I'm quite, you know, whatever, pal. Yeah, I'll just dig a hole under you, around you, and go around you, mate. Get out of my way.
Yeah.
But as other people, those microaggressions wear them down. So to answer your question, what I focus a lot on is helping people to, you know, be the best they can be, achieve their ambitions without going through a lot of pain that I went through. Because I went to a comprehensive school in a mill town in Lancashire. You know, for me to get into university, I did my A-levels twice. To get a job in the city was hard work. To get a job in banking was even hard work. But I managed to do it. So this morning, I was a friend of mine, Shah Wasman. She had an event with the Rise of the Female Entrepreneur. So you think, women are doing all right? Well, actually, less than 2% of venture capital goes into women-led businesses, right? If you're a black woman, only one black woman had raised more than $1 million of venture capital in the UK in a decade.
Fucking hell.
So if you look at entrepreneurship, let's look at entrepreneurship. And when I was on the board of British Business Bank, we did some research called the Loan Together Report. And this is more about ethnic minorities, but it's the same for women. It can be white working class lads as well. It said, look, they invest more money in their businesses. They're better educated, which surprised me. Actually, maybe it shouldn't, but it surprised me. And they spend more time and energy on it, but their outcomes are always worse. And the way I kind of try to explain that is, it's like, and I've experienced this, it's like you're a 100-meter race, right? You've done the same training, the same physique, you've got the same kit, and you're ready to go. And someone then says to you, yeah, mate, can you just start 50 yards back? Because typically, you've got a bit of a longer journey to even get to the start line. So you start 50 yards back. And then in your lane, they start putting out hurdles. You're like, well, hang on a minute, he hasn't got hurdles. I knew the hurdles. I knew that, you know, my school I went to work in a city, you know, mixed race. I went to a pretty, let's just say it wasn't Oxbridge, right? And I knew there were hurdles. I'm like, okay, there's hurdles. I'm going to deal with these hurdles. Let's do this. And you start running. And as you're getting over this hurdle, you start to realize, bloody, there's invisible hurdles. Well, you put those there. And that's bias. And then the things that you don't know they're there until you actually experience them. Or sometimes you don't even know it's happening to you, but it's kind of there and it's affecting you. Now, if you're a woman, say invisible hurdles, maybe not invisible, depending on who you are, but then you're starting 100 meters back.
Mm.
That's how I imagine. That's what the research literally showed. So my point is that we collectively should try and make sure everyone has a fair pop at it. Yeah, I'm not saying that you should be assisted if you're particularly a woman or an ethnic minority or a white working class lad. I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying you all have a right to get on the flipping start line.
Mm.
Then it's down to you, let's face it.
Yeah, well, because that's the thing. It always felt like, well, actually, there are, you can imagine the trying to be an actor or an actress. I get it. Like, there are so many kind of setbacks, but you always felt that if it's business and it's your own thing, well, you can build it. But when you talk about it like that with the bias, so if you could go back to younger peers and the advice that you probably give to people now when you're having these conversations, saying, just so you know, watch out for X, Y, this is how you handle this. What are those things?
So it depends who they are and their background. So I was in the first wave of internet 1.0, literally, in 2000. And if you look back at the first wave of internet entrepreneurs, most of them were wealthy. You know, mum and daddy had money, or they were bankers, or they were consultants. So they could afford to take a couple of years out. And I thought that was me. So I left Credit Suisse First Boston with my bonus. You know, more money than my parents probably earned put together in a year. I had this cash. And I thought, well, I'll take 2 years out, hitch up my wagon and head west and dot-com gold rush. Here we go. And worst case scenario, I can always go back to the city. So as I leave the city, across this bridge into the internet, the dot-com bubble burst. So my bridge back was like literally like incinerated. So I was kind of like, oh, well, okay. So I was kind of like left on this island with no way back to the city because I'd fired everybody. So from then on, for me, it was kind of like, right, okay, I've got to sort of just go forwards. And that's what I say to people is that I do think that, you know, business is something that everyone should try once. I think there's a bit like a book. There's a business in everybody.
Mm.
But your ability to, people say, oh, you know, follow your passion. I don't actually agree with that. I think you should do something you're good at, to be quite frank, which might be a passion. It might not be a passion. But I say to people, find something you're very good at, you can be world-class at, or at least competitive at. Use artificial intelligence to sort of augment yourself and give it a go. But realize that there comes a day or point where it might not be working out, and you need to know when to stop. And often, most entrepreneurs I talk to, or people who, even in careers actually, I say, increasingly, it's not going to be the first career that makes you. It won't be the first business that makes you. It'll be number two, three, even four. And if you're expecting now to have a career, expect to change it four times and retrain along the way. So what I'm saying to people now, to answer your question really, is you're going to need even more resilience than you even used to have. And you're going to have to be flexible. And you're going to have to be quite willing to retrain and learn new skills as technology is like chasing you down the street.
Have you heard of Gary's Economics?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so if he'd heard that point you just said then around starting your own business, he'd have probably gone absolutely insane.
That's because he'd never started a business.
So talk about that. So what do you think of that advice?
So, I mean, you know, there's something like Simon Squibb and, you know, Gary. So I'll see these things. And, you know, business is not for everybody. It's not a panacea. But I think everybody should try it once. And it might be a side hustle. There are so many amazing businesses that come across. You know, the ones, you know, anyone listening or watching this will probably know and love. And it came from somebody who never thought they're ever going to be an entrepreneur in business. Started something, and it might be a passion, might be something that is good at, and it clicked and off they went. Because working for other people, right, I don't know what Gary thinks about this one, but working for the people, jobs, forget AI, is going away. Because increasingly, and you saw the thin end of a fat wedge, you know, 0 hour contracts. Organizations don't want human resource. They don't want fixed costs sitting on in their P&L, whether, you know, they're working or not. They want people in discrete teams to deliver projects and outcomes. It might be a day, a week, a month, it might be 3 years. But you come together, you've got an objective, you deliver it. You might work in little groups because that's like an organization, like a team. You could even call it a company. But the idea, I think, of a salary and a job isn't long for this world, especially if you start thinking about artificial intelligence, because eventually we will report to AIs. No one ever grasps that one, do they?
Can't leave us on that.
People are saying that, we're going to be working with AIs. You know, if you think about an artificial intelligence, are the ones now, the ones that can actually properly reason, which are going to come eventually, one way or the other. They've got access to all the business information in real time, the customers, the market, trends in real time, right? So when you're trying to manage people in the business or organization, these discrete teams are going to be employed on these like 0-hour contracts. AIs are going to be much better at it because they've got the insight in real time to say, actually, today we should be doing this. They're not reacting, a week, 2 weeks or a month later when they've read some reports or looked at some data that's been generated in a board pack. So eventually the day will come where you go to work and you're told what to do on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis by an artificial intelligence.
Naval Ravikant's got this prediction that we'll have like gig culture. So it'll almost be, I accept so gig.
This is what I'm talking about. Well, maybe it's like a different thing. I'm talking about the gig economy is coming for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's his thing of it'll almost be, I take a gig with a discrete team. We complete the work, we take our money, and then we go and do whatever we're doing for a bit, and then you accept another one rather than having 9 to 5 Monday to
Friday. So the point I'm making, going back to the question you asked, is if we're all gig economy workers on 0-hour contracts, okay, augmented by artificial intelligence or even managed by it, even recruited by it, because that knows what human resources is. That's the interview. Yeah. So if you think about that, then we're all in business. We might be one-man bands, we might be one-man consultancies, we might team together in a little group because we like working together and we're quite good at delivering projects like this. But we all become, going back to the Industrial Revolution, units of production that have to go and find work and market ourselves and network or get our AIs to go and talk to 435,000 AIs looking for someone with my skill set. So that's the thing about it. I think that I kind of agree that not business is not for everybody because it can be quite stressful, but I think eventually we're all going to end up units of production.
I can see that, and eventually the people that don't want to adapt will die out. That's happening. Piers, obviously that there's you're a wealth of knowledge, and I think like what you said at the beginning, taking those complex ideas. I've got so many ideas just from this conversation alone. We probably couldn't have you on the podcast and not talk about something that you probably get peppered with all the time. Dragon's Den, I guess, take us back. Where were you at in your life and how did that come about?
It is bonkers, isn't it? So Dragon's Den to me, my life, right, was probably 9.5-10 weeks of filming at a studio in Manchester. I turned up for 2 stints of 5 weeks and 10 years later, I kind of still can't walk down the street without, some 17-year-old saying, oh, hello, can I have a selfie to my mates on Snap? And I'm like, what the hell? And because they keep replaying it. So how I ended up on Dragon's Den, So I'm kind of this sort of mixed race entrepreneur, made a bit of money, ended up on the list of the 100 most influential Black Britons. My dad used to, who's now no longer with us, he used to take the mickey out of me saying, in at 99, somewhere done. Yeah, I was like, whatever. So I was on this list, which is nice, bit of PR, to be honest, I was quite proud of being on it. And then through that, you've got some researcher and some TV production company. Again, we need someone who's like, ticks boxes, so that I'm sure that's what they're thinking. There I am. So the first thing I did was The Secret Millionaire. This is like 2011. So I was approached to do it because I had this profile. And it was two halves to it. One was where I was in Wolverhampton helping community organisations. And the other half, I was in a Young Offenders. So when they put it out, they only put out the part where I was in the Young Offenders. And I was like, hang on a minute. I gave most money from the other part, which I never actually put on TV. So I was like, anyway. So I'm in this Young Offenders. And there's a slight side story there, going back to our previous conversation. So I met a young lad called, let's call him Nathan. He was in there. I met him. He was teaching other prisoners to learn to read. Anyway, I thought, what are you doing inside? Because he's obviously quite intelligent and bright. He goes, he did some things he probably shouldn't have done, Got caught and got quite a stiff sentence. And I said, well, when you get out, and the producer's like, whoa, you can't help the prisoner, give him money. I go, I'm going to give him money. When he gets out, I'll help him. So he came out, I mentored him a little bit. He learned to work for me for a while, made him redundant, it's quite awkward. And they started some businesses, went back to work in IT. And now, you know, what, 10 years later, he's probably earns over 150 grand a year. He's some kind of cloud infrastructure architect, right? Mm. So that just shows you that, going back to my point earlier, if you give people a bit of support and guidance, if you deflect someone 10 years downrange, they end up somewhere else. Anyway, so I'm on this program, did my thing, 15 minutes of fame. That was it. So obviously then that researcher, I think, moves to BBC. They're looking for someone to tick boxes on Dragon's Den. And my name came up. So the first year, they kind of approached me. It didn't happen. I wasn't too sure about doing it, to be honest with you. Anyway, they went off and did it with somebody else joined. But then the following year, they said, do you want to do it? And I thought, you know what? Why not? Because I've always done B2B. So you can't look at me and go, oh, he's that guy of that company, and walk down the high street and buy whatever I'm selling. Yeah. It wasn't that. I never did that. So I kind of thought, right, okay, I don't know what to do. So the producers are chasing me. And I'd gone to an event with Sir Richard Branson, who'd, I think it was like 60 grand to go on holiday with him. And I was like, yeah, why not? So I gave some money to his charity, and off we went on this trip with him. I gave it to Virgin United, actually. That's what it was all about. And I was at Usaba, which is his private game reserve in the Kruger National Park in South Africa. And it's like a James Bond like film set. It's like the bush is quite flat. It's that rocky outcrop with like a satellite dish on top of it. And it's like a 6-star hotel with like infinity pools, overlooking lions chasing impala. It's bonkers. So I'm there with Sir Richard hanging out thinking, what the hell? And I thought, who do I talk to about the media and business and how you put the two together and does it work? And the obvious answer was Sir Richard. So I can't remember how exactly it happened, but when we had a chat over a beer literally. And I went through the whole thing of him. He said, look, you should do it. He said, you know, you'd be good on TV. He said, I always remember him saying this, unless I've just made it up in my head. I'm pretty sure he said to me, I used to get on a plane for a good TV spot. That's what he said. I thought, okay, let's do it then. So I kind of said, okay, I'll do it. And as I walked away, I remember to this day, he made me ring the producers back there and then and tell them I'm in. And I still know to this day. And that's how I ended up on Dragon's Den.
And then what, I mean, From a business, so you're looking at kind of the future, that this was 10 years ago. What business opportunities has that brought on? What doors has that opened for you?
So no direct business opportunities. So what it does is people take your phone call. So that's quite powerful. So if I contact somebody or I want to meet somebody, it's quite likely I can get in a room with them, right? Mm. And that's quite good. What's quite interesting though is sometimes you're in rooms with people who they're quite competitive, you know, they might even be billionaires and they're like, you know, they're talking about this and that and the other. I'm kind of like, right. But they can never be a dragon. we can't buy it. So it opened doors. I probably would not have ended up on the, you know, board of the government bank. I didn't have that particular profile because I was kind of like a bit of an SME kind of champion. So that's why I was kind of ended up on the board. I kind of represented the UK SME population. And you know, I've been able to do things that I would never have been able to do before. But the main thing I would say is that it opens doors. The people will take your phone call and that's worth something.
Mm.
It was a bit weird because I was kind of on Dragon's Den. And then I kind of had a business that didn't really work out. And then I kind of went quiet for a few years. And my partner said, you should get work on social media and post some stuff. I was like, okay, if I have to. So I started like posting things on LinkedIn and kind of got back on the horse, really. And then it kind of came back again. And then I quite enjoy like doing keynotes and explaining things to people. And I guess the business side of things is that when you, like even recruiting people, you know, people think they don't know you, but they feel as though they know you. And that's quite powerful in a way.
Mm.
But it's also the flip side of it is people think they know you and they don't know you. They know a caricature that the BBC created of it. So Dragon's Den, it's like a multiverse, right? I'll explain it. So they come out of the lift, which is not a lift. It doesn't move. This is a box. So they come out of this pretend lift. You've got your pretend 50s. And they walk over and then they pitch you. So that's all real. Like they never stop the cameras. It's real. At the end of the pitch, you sort of say, okay, I'm going to invest or I'm not. That's all real. So you shake hands and then you don't hand over the cash there and then a suitcase and off they go. Let me know in 10 years if you sell the business. You go off and do it. So then the one multiverse is you go off, lawyers, accountants, shareholder agreement, subscription agreement. You do an angel investment, a rip proper one. Sometimes due diligence, what they told you on TV isn't reality either. That's a whole different multiverse. So it's not reality, so the deal doesn't happen. Or maybe they're there for the PR, or it goes on for so long, the show's aired, and they get a better offer. Fair enough. Doesn't happen. Right? So that's my work. That's my experience. The TV producers have now got a lot of content trapped on a hard drive somewhere, and they're going to make a TV show out of it. So they take it away, probably an hour and a half, and they'll edit it down to 3 minutes for the snippets, and maybe 12, 15 minutes for the long form pitches. And then they go away and they'll be like, and they'll show it on TV and I'll watch it. And they'll be like, well, Piers didn't invest because he didn't like the brand. And the guy started crying. And you're like, well, I didn't invest actually. Because if you go into the detail of what really happened, he did start crying because we weren't going to invest. But it's because he's got a subsidiary of a Canadian franchise. And that just doesn't work. And he's in the IP anyway. And they're like, well, it doesn't work. That's why I didn't invest. But that's not a good story for TV.
No.
So they create these caricatures. And I think even like... and Deborah Meaden's character, it's like the dragon, you know. I think that's just 1990s misogyny. Yeah. You know, now the female investors will never have that kind of personality. Deborah's the nicest lady you'll ever want to meet, quite literally. So I think they create a caricature of you, and it's not you. What people think is you. And people meet me, and they look at me, and you can see them looking at me, and they're kind of like, where do I know this guy from? Yeah, I've been in like nightclubs in Ibiza and guys all night go, mate. He's like, mate, look who it is. And I'm kind of like, oh, hello. And he's like, oh, get you some drinks. And all night, he's like, get you some more drinks. And I'm all right. I'm seriously, I'm all right. He's like, no, you know, I want to look after you. You know, I think you're fantastic. I'm like, okay, it's very nice of you. End of the night, I'm kind of like, I've really got to go. And he's like, look, it's been great to meet you. You're an amazing rugby player. I'm like, oh God, bottle of wine. So people recognize you, but they don't quite know where from. I get that all the time.
That's brilliant.
We're like, gee, I know you. And I'm like, yeah, I'm about to say, yeah, I was on Dragon's Den. They go, you work in Barclays in Camden. Funny.
That'll do. So then I was thinking, we were obviously, we're watching a bit last night just to be, be prepared. Now you said that, I'm thinking, let's say someone says a comment about a business and you take umbrage with it and then it'll pan to your face and it's like a visual reaction. Has that actually happened or not really chopping that in afterwards?
Yeah, so I think they have to, they can't completely make it up. So, you know, if it's typical, those reactions are real. You might get the odd thing when they're editing it, like for a teaser or something where somebody might say something and you'll go, and that might be taken for somewhere else. But generally speaking, what was interesting, when I was on Dragon's Den, it was in factual. So it's quite a different approach to the content, whereas now it's in entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different, it was in our BBC One now, is it?
Yeah.
Which is entertainment. I was on BBC Two. It was factual. So a slightly different approach to the whole programme. I haven't watched Dragon's Den since I didn't watch it before I was on it. I didn't watch it. I haven't watched it since I've been on it. It's really, really quite odd, actually. I hear about it, and I see clips, obviously, sometimes on like YouTube, places like that. But I haven't really watched it since. But I like to think that I was the first to do like proper deals, like, you know, taking 5% for a sensible amount of money.
Mm.
Not, I'll give you 50 grand for 68% of your business. You know, I was the first to do, like, you know, lost my name wonderably. It was, they wanted to give away 4% for a million, for 100 grand. I got 5% in the end. And all the dragons in the green room were like, that's not what this about. That's just, don't do deals like that. And I was like, whatever. And then that, you know, I won't go into details, but that turned out to be probably the most successful deal ever on Dragon's Den.
Mm.
And they sold it for cash.
Nice.
It's like a 43X, something like that.
Wow. Is there, I don't know if you'd be allowed to say this, are there like maximums and minimums? So they're like, you've got to put this amount of money in, you've got to invest in this amount of businesses.
No, none of that. It's real. But what I would say, what made me laugh is the producers, they didn't want to tell you anything, but they might want to tee up a little bit. So they might say, well, the next one's like, it's a bit, they used to say like business lessons, or I think it's quite investable. They think it might make good TV or whatever. And they come out and it was always a completely other way around because they didn't have a clue. They come out, what are you talking about investable? They don't have a clue about what you'd invest in. So that always made me laugh. But it is real. But like I said, it then splits into two multiverses. One's TV, going to make a TV show. And one, you are going to spend the next, let's face it, 10 years building a business working with these people.
Mm.
And you know, I've been involved with some of them probably 3 to 5, and then they become sort of lifestyle, or they don't want you there anymore because it's not going to go. So you sort of get your money back essentially. Some didn't work out, and then like a venture capital fund, one does spectacularly well, but it's quite rare. I think investments do that well.
Mm. We were talking about Wonderbly last night. I think we both bought it for our kids at some point, and it's one of those. So in terms of, so it sounds like it's actually full on hands you're involved. Like it's not just a case of there's the money, see you later.
Well, some people have like a team that gets involved. I was involved personally, but you're not involved every day. It's like an angel investment, isn't it? Mm. So you might get involved if there's some PR or to put a fire out or need some support. You might be like a chairman's type of figure, maybe an advisor, but you're not really in it day to day, hands on. I used to always have a bet with the people on the show that when it goes out, your website's going to crash. They'd be like, "No, it's not. I've got virtual servers, dynamic," and I'd be like, "Okay." And the only people whose website stayed up was Lost My Name, Wonderbly guys, because they actually knew what they were doing.
Well, Piers, this conversation has been amazing. There's been so many takeaways. Thank you so much for joining us. If people want to work with you, check you out, how can they get in touch? What should they be doing?
So the day job, I'm a founder again, 14 hours a day, is implementai.io. So you can just, if you Google the word implement, I think we come up like number 3 on Google. It's nuts.
Wow.
Yeah, or implement AI, we're there. Well, we've done no SEO, nothing.
Wow.
So you can talk about that later, how that's happened. But I think it's just like the podcast and the YouTube. But Implement AI, we just come up in top 3 ranking globally. And then I've got my own website, piersleny.com, if you're interested in my other work and a bit more about me and my background. That's on there. But thank you for having me.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.